come here and to study your word, the book of Daniel, and the truth it contains, the evidence of your prophecy declared through him coming true. Many of his prophecies have already happened. Some are yet to come. And we know that those that are yet to come will come to pass because, one, you cannot lie. You told the truth in the first place, and it will come to pass. But also, those prophecies that have come to pass, prove your trustworthiness, your faithfulness. I pray as we see the darkness of the world's kingdoms and the darkness of the hearts of the kings and the darkness of the peoples over which they rule, that despite the darkness, there is light. You have shined your light into the world. Your Son is the light of the world. And one day, the light will return. And so, in the meantime, I pray we would draw encouragement from this text tonight that is here to strengthen our faith in you and our resolve to walk with you and our commitment to be the light in this dark world. We pray for help tonight in Jesus' name. Amen. So Daniel chapter 7. I gave you guys I can't remember how many notes on yours. You got more than usual because it's a lot of details going on in this text. So hopefully it's helpful to you. And if not, ask questions and so forth. And hopefully we can help you if you need help. But the triumphant kingdom of God, Daniel 7, 1 through 28. I'll just go ahead and read the text. So, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire, like a river of fire, I think is what it is referring to there. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then, because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things that seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for it, the ten horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time, times and a half time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. The triumphant kingdom of God. So Daniel 7 is considered the most important part of the book of Daniel. It's the most important section of Daniel. And that's for a lot of reasons. As we read that, I think you can probably pick up on one of the big reasons. We see the Ancient of Days talked about. We see the Son of Man alluded to here, coming with the clouds. And it's a pivotal. It's, you know, just like a door moving on those. Brittany's out there. Is someone coming to the door? Okay, good. They let her in. Sorry. I saw Brittany outside the door. I was making sure she could get in. Very good. So it's like the door hinges, the linchpin. That's the word I was trying to think of when I saw her walk up to the door. The linchpin, that door swings on it, hinges on it, right? Well, this is a pivotal moment in the book of Daniel. And so what's going on with Daniel 7 is everything prior to Daniel 7 is what we call historical narrative mainly. Now, there's some prophecy mixed in and stuff, but it's pretty much a history. It's what happened. You know, Daniel in the lion's den is a historical event, right? The shift now is going to what we call apocalyptic or prophetic, apocalyptic language. Now, there's history involved, obviously. The visions were historical event, but the visions are also apocalyptic. But they're apocalyptic language about historical events. So we're not leaving history completely. But the point is, we're talking history, and now the door swings open toward the rest of Daniel. Everything else in the rest of Daniel has been prepared for by the first 6 chapters. The first six chapters were to prepare Daniel's readers and hearers for everything else. And here's what it prepared them for. The God who was faithful to the 3 Hebrew men and Daniel time and again, and delivering them and saving them miraculously. That God is the same God who's going to deliver the saints, God's people, when these world kingdoms come on the scene. And things are going to look really dark, especially when we get to the fourth beast. God will be faithful. God will deliver. God will be victorious. Okay, and so chronologically speaking, chronological order of chapters 7 through 12. And Revelation does this too, by the way. Revelation does it even more, and that's what makes it so tricky to interpret. Daniel is actually going back to the beginning of the book, or close to the beginning. Not all the way to Nebuchadnezzar, almost, but back to Belshazzar. So visions 1 and 2 are during the Babylonian period. Remember, we were in Babylon, then we were in Persia, and then we finally got to Daniel 7, and now we're going back to Babylon briefly. So the Babylonian period. Chapter 7 is the first year of Belshazzar, 553 B.C. Chapter 8 is third year of Belshazzar. So we're all the way back in the Babylonian period. Then visions 3 and 4 is during the Medo-Persian period. Chapter 9 is the first year of Darius, also known as Cyrus the Mede. And chapter 10 is the third year of Cyrus, also known as Darius the Mede, the same guy. I made that argument last week, so if you missed that, too bad. So, we can get you the notes on that if you need them. And so, the next section. So, what is this chapter dealing? What's the deal with the four kingdoms? Well, the idea is there's this persistent progression of evil in the world. Evil has always been around. If we're not careful, we'll get into this mode of thinking that things have never been like this before. Well, that may be true, but yet, on the other hand, we got to remember Ecclesiastes says there's nothing new under the sun, good or evil, right? Now, there's new versions of evil. There's maybe an intensification of evil at times. I'm okay with saying that. Even Jesus says, you know, prior to his return, like a woman in travail, in pregnancy, giving birth, that intensity grows, the frequency grows. So I'm okay with saying that. But as far as evil itself, evil has always been around since the garden. And there's a progression of it in the sense that it's a persistency. It just keeps going. It just keeps going. And if you're not careful, if we're not careful, we'll throw our hands up and go, what's the point, Lord? You know, we can get really discouraged because evil is pervasive and progressive. So let's look at some of this language here. We see in verse 2, the four winds of heaven. He declared, I saw in the night vision, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. What are the four winds of heaven? Well, probably it really can be a picture of two things. Some people would say it's one or the other. I would argue it's probably a little bit of both. So the four winds of heavens indicate this universal chaos caused by the rise and fall of nations. There's something always going on. The four winds from the four corners of the earth, from all about. When nation does this, it creates this domino effect over here. It's like a wave of the sea, and we'll talk about the sea in a moment. The four winds blowing in onto the sea, creating this chaos. World leaders can't help themselves but just to keep stuff stirred up. If it's not this nation, it's another nation. If it's not the United States, it's China. If it's not China, it's Russia. If it's not Russia, it's England. If it's not England, it's Australia. Someone is always stirring up something, is the idea. So the first, four winds of heaven, that's kind of the idea. But it's not just about the nations, this universal chaos that they create. It's remembering that God is the sovereign above all the nations, and that there's this universal nature of judgment. God is using the chaos as a part of his judgments. And we see that in this text. We know that Nebuchadnezzar, the Bible tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was God's ordained, appointed means for disciplining who? Israel. Judah. Right? Judah sinned, and God says, because you have forsaken me. You can find this in Isaiah, Jeremiah. There's other texts as well, back in probably 2 Kings, those books. God says, because you have forsaken me, I am appointing the Chaldeans, Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to destroy you. They're going to come, and they're going to destroy you, and they're going to take you into exile. Then God appoints the Persians, the Medo-Persians, to punish Nebuchadnezzar. And then he appoints Alexander the Great of Greece to punish the Persians. And then he's going to appoint the Romans to punish the Greeks. You see the point I'm trying to make. So on one hand, The four winds of the heavens is a stirring up that the nations cause, yet it's also God sovereignly judging the nations. Okay? Any questions so far? All right, we're just getting into it, right? What about the sea there? He says in verse 2 that the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. It's pretty universal throughout Scripture. The majority of time, the sea is a picture of peoples, or entire nations of peoples. Okay, we see this in verses 2 and 3 as well here in our text. Isaiah chapter 57, verse 20. Did I put that on your sheet? I think I did. Let's look it up then. If I put it on your sheet, I have to go to it, right? If I just put it on my sheet, you may never know that I had it on there and I can skip it. But why would we want to skip it, right? Verse 20. Isaiah 57, 20. But the wicked are like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet. And its waters toss up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked, he goes on to say. And so the sea here, the sea in the Revelation is peoples. Okay, the beasts rise up out of the seas. They emerge from out amidst the people. Right. And so you see the turbulence of the sea. But before the throne of God, you see a crystal sea. Tranquil, peaceful, clean, pure. You see the imagery? There's no chaos in heaven. There's no mire and dirt being tossed up. It's a crystal sea. That's the picture there. So that's the imagery there. Then they get to the four beasts. The four beasts. These are kings and kingdoms. It's not just kingdoms. It's not just kings. It's kind of kings and the kingdoms that they represent. We see this in verses 1 through 8. Also in verse 15 through 17. That's how we know that the four beasts are kings and kingdoms, because verses 15 through 17 confirm it. That's where the interpretation we'll discuss later comes into play. Cross-reference the statue of Daniel chapter 2. You remember the statue? You had Babylon, the Medo-Persians. You had the Greeks and the Romans. Right, from head to foot. There. It's not coincidental. The statue and the beast imagery, each one has its own. They're overlapping things that are the same, but there's also unique characteristics to each one. So they fill in information for each other. So what does Daniel see? Verses 3 and 4. He sees a lion with eagle wings. What nation does this represent, do you think? Oh, we got it on the sheet for you, so you get the sheet. Did you know that before? I gave you the sheet. Yeah. Lion with eagle's wings is Babylon. Now, we can look in the text and see that this is true. It says it had wings, but they were plucked off. But then the beast was lifted up from the ground like a man who was right in the head. Who does that sound like? What happened just a few chapters ago? Nebuchadnezzar. That's a picture of Nebuchadnezzar. So the king, he was like a lion with wings, powerful being. And by the way, that's how he's described in the verses there, Jeremiah 4, 49, 50. That's how he is described, as a lion. Okay. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, what did they have on lots of their walls? And pottery and so forth, so on. They had a lion with eagle's wings. The Ishtar Gate has lions with eagle's wings on it. So the Bible, God knows exactly what he's doing here, right? So Nebuchadnezzar was a mighty lion, proud. And God humbled him and threw him, plucked his wings off. But then 7 years later, he rose up from the ground a man. He came to his senses. I believe he was converted. He became a saved man, redeemed. So that's the picture that we see here. Then number 2 is the bear. Verse 5. This is Medo-Persia, the Medes and the Persians. Notice Daniel says the bear is raised up on one side. So he's a deformed bear, but don't think that means he's not vicious or powerful. He's very powerful. He's raised up on one side. Why? Because one side is bigger than the other. Think Medo-Persian, the Medes and the Persians. The Medes, I mean, it was a confederacy of the two, but though they were one together, one bear, the Persians were a little stronger. They were bigger, more significant. They became, over time, became more significant part of that confederacy. Okay? The bear has three ribs in his mouth. Now, this could just simply mean be a picture of the voraciousness, the power, the strength of the Medo-Persian Empire, and that would be accurate. But it could literally have a fulfillment in this way, that there were three, if you look at their history, there are three major victories like that stood out from all the others. Three major victories. One would be, you know, the one of them, Babylon. That's the first major victory, 539 B.C. Then the people of Lydia. Yes, it's a place. My poor daughter, she's named Lydia. She goes, what does my name mean, Dad? I said, well, it means the city of Lydia. She's like, oh, okay. I said, but Lydia was a great godly woman in the Bible, and that's why we named you that. But her name means, I mean, it'd be like, what does Lebanon mean? We named you after the city Lebanon. Okay, great. The name Lebanon may have a deeper meaning than that. I don't know. But Lydia literally means Lydia. So anyway, but Lydia was a major victory, 546 B.C. And then they had their third major victory was Egypt in 525 B.C. So most likely these three ribs are representing these three conquests that they made. Number three, verse six, we see this leopard with four wings and four heads. Now, if you're following me with the statue, down the statue, then you should know what this kingdom is, too. What kingdom is this? It's on your sheet. The Greeks. Leopard with four wings. If you ever seen a leopard run fast, put some wings on them. Ooh, I think even faster, swift. Sarah and I, when we were in Zimbabwe the first year, we were sitting out like a campfire with some people and just kind of hanging out. And one of the African men said, oh, there's a leopard. And we looked up, and the floodlights from where we were at, it wasn't like they had electricity at this particular place, but not much, but they did. And anyway, the floodlights, you could almost see a little bit of something, and it was like, boom, like that. So, well, I saw a leopard, you know, not really, right? They're really quick, really quick. Put some wings on that sucker. They were Alexander the Great and the Greeks were swift in battle and ferocious. Up until that point, probably the world hadn't seen an army like that, is what I would argue. He invaded Asia Minor in 334 B.C., and within 10 short years, he had conquered Medo-Persia. And you go, well, man, it took him 10 years. Medo-Persian Empire was huge. Huge. No internet, no satellites, no missiles of modern day kind anyway, no automated weaponry, old-fashioned, toe-to-toe battles. 10 years, he wiped them out. And by age 33, he had conquered all the known world. He was the king of the world. And the story is told that he cried. He wept and cried and says, I have no more worlds to conquer. That's where he got all his joy. He drank himself to death, legend tells it. He drank himself to death. He was so depressed. He had no more battles to win. And so what happened? This leopard with four wings suddenly has four heads, verse 6, he says. One kingdom becomes four, in essence. It's really just one kingdom. One kingdom becomes four, has four leaders, comes divided into four. That's a better way of saying it. Did I put this on your sheet, the names of them? Okay, good. I meant to, so I was hoping I did. And I'll pass over them briefly because I know some of y'all were like history. Who cares? But Antipater and Cassander ruled one section. Lysimachus ruled another section. Seleucus the First ruled a third section. And the fourth section was ruled by Ptolemy the First. Ptolemy the First Soter. The previous was Seleucus the First Nicator. Now, what do you think probably happened eventually? You know what happened eventually? Beast number four is going to come. this kingdom could not stand. They had good intentions. They thought, we'll hold the kingdom together with these four chiefs, these four generals of Alexander the Great. But they weren't able to. The kingdom started splitting apart and civil wars happened. And they became very weak. And they became ripe pickings for the Roman Empire to come in. Which leads us to the last beast. I'm calling him the mystery beast. Not because we don't have details about who it is. And not because we don't believe we know who it is. But the beast itself, there's no description, is there? Except about his teeth and his claws. Not compared to a bear or a lion or a whatever. It's just a fourth beast, not like any of the others. That's what the Bible says. That's all we know. And so it's this mystery beast. And this is Rome. Verse 7 and verse 19. Verse 7, we did read it. But verse 7 says, is terrifying and dreadful with iron teeth. You go back to the statue, Daniel 2. What part of the statue was made out of iron? The legs down here. So in the feet, iron and clay, Roman Empire. So that's not coincidental. Iron teeth. Regular teeth are bad enough, right? But iron teeth, that's pretty terrifying. And then verse 19 says they had bronze claws. Bronze claws. Different than all the other beasts. Verse 7 and 8, 10 horns on its head. There's no such beast in human science. But then there's an 11th horn. It starts off as a little horn. Apparently it grows to be bigger because more significant, the text says, than its companions. This 11th horn, verse 8, plucked up three of the first of the 10 horns. Apparently the rest just sort of went along with him, got absorbed into him. But three of the 10 fought back, but they lost. And then verse 8, the 11th horn is said to have eyes of a man and mouth speaking boastful things. It's interesting. That's part of what makes it different than the other three beasts. The other three beasts were animals. Bear, you know, lion, bear, leopard. They have eyes, but they don't have eyes of man, right? They have mouths, but they can't speak like a man. So this is telling us that this fourth beast, specifically this little horn, is going to be extremely knowledgeable and wise and venerable, respected, standing out among the crowd. And there is one man in the New Testament that the Bible seems to indicate will be like that. And we call him the Antichrist. Okay. I do believe, well, I'll save that. So, Rome is this fourth beast. Any questions so far? Clear as mud. Good. Yeah. Some of it is coming. I mean, Daniel's in the 500s B.C. Right. Yeah, Daniel's in the 500s B.C. The vision begins during the Babylonian period. And so he's telling the Jews of what's going to come. Okay. And so the Persians come within about 50, 60 years, 70. I can't remember the exact number. Because I'm not good with numbers and remembering them. But so say in a generation and a half. And then the Persians will be in power about 100, 200 years almost. And then the Greeks will come into pass. So the Greeks are going to be, what's that, 150 years past Daniel, probably, thereabouts. And then the Romans, of course, are going to be closer to about 350, 400 years. Does that help a little bit? Yeah. Yeah, yes, yeah. As far as when he's speaking on the vision, yes. But remember, Daniel lives during the second beast too, Persia. So he was thrown in the lion's den by the Persians, right? By Cyrus or Darius the Mede, yeah. So we studied that last week. So Daniel lived during the period of the first beast and the second beast. And as far as we know, there's no way he would have made it to the Greek. There's no way he can make it to the Greek beast. Third. Yeah. Okay. So this next section, kind of the last section, but it's still a lot here. Evil as a means of God accomplishing his righteous purposes. So right in the middle of, it is in the middle of this, you get the vision, and I went ahead and gave you a lot of the interpretation, which comes at the end really though, right? So you get the vision, get the interpretation at the end, but right in the middle, you got the answer to the problem. And it's the Ancient of Days and his Son of Man. Okay? So Ancient of Days is another reference to God. To Yahweh. You can say God the Father if you wanted to. The only problem with that is I wouldn't want to limit it to just saying that, because I do think we got to leave wiggle room for the Trinity here. And by that I mean, you get this description of clothing as white as snow and hair like wool. You get the New Testament in Revelation, and Christ has this white woolen hair, right? This appearance of purity like this. And so there's this overlapping of imagery. It's like, well, is it God the Father? Is it God the Son? And so I just want us to, again, we got to be careful because it's apocalyptic language. And you don't build your Trinitarian understanding from apocalyptic language, okay? You have to be careful about building a lot of your theology from apocalyptic language because it's highly symbolic. But nonetheless, the Ancient of Days, I would say, is a title for Yahweh, okay? His clothing white as snow. What do you think that stands for? Clothing as white as snow. Perfection. Clean. Yeah. Sinless. Holy. Purity. Those things. Yeah. Hair like wool. Hair like wool. I think. Yeah. Hey. So what does your hair stand for, Donna? Wisdom. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So we could say, well, it's woolen hair. Maybe that's pure, holy. Well, maybe so. But I think because it's on the head, think wisdom, longevity, right? Longevity, going to be here a while. Because generally speaking, the white woolen haired folks are the older people. And there's that wisdom there and the longevity. They've been around a while. And so just the title Ancient of Days tells us, you're dealing with an ancient being. More than ancient, we're dealing with who? An eternal being. Eternal, forever. And then he says there was a fiery throne. What do you think a fiery throne would stand for, symbolize? What's that?
Power.
Yes. Power. Yeah. Yes. Which would, sorry, were you finished? Yeah. Judgment, yeah. Which is tied to cleansing of impurities. So here's the thing. Whether God's judgment, whether God cleanses a person in salvation or destroys a person in judgment, there's a type of a cleansing going on, right? There's a purification. There's no sin in the presence of God. You're not coming into heaven. So if you're not going to be cleaned up in salvation, you have to be separated in judgment. And so the fiery throne is power and salvation, I would say, and judgment as a part of that as well. Okay. Yeah, I would say so, probably. Well, okay, let me back up. First of all, I don't know. I've never seen the throne of God. Technically, we don't know. I think it is mostly metaphor. Mostly. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Right. Yeah. 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 Yeah, no, I know. I know you're not. I get your point. Yeah. I would think, first of all, we don't know technically. I think first and foremost, it's mainly metaphorical, okay? But doesn't mean it could not be literal, too. But I personally would say I think it's just metaphor. But as I've heard it said many times, that does not decrease the significance or the impact of the language or of the reality, the true reality of the throne. It doesn't lessen the intensity. Metaphorical language actually intensifies it. Why? Because it is so intense, we don't have the literal words to describe it. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? And so God's throne is like a fiery, it's like fire. So, oh, that's just metaphor. It's not that intense. No, it's that intense. How do you even describe such power and judgment? You see the difference there? Yeah, okay. Good, great question, though. And as a side note as well, I mean, Daniel, it's not a side note, Daniel says it, but he talks about this, the wheels of fire. And it's very common in the ancient world for the people to depict or picture their gods like on these chariot-type thrones. That was very common. And so God uses that same kind of language, not because he's a pagan god, but because he's trying to help people understand he's the one true God. He's the only one true God sitting on a fiery throne with fiery wheels on it. Fully powerful, fully judge, the full judge. Okay, he goes on to say thousands and thousands serve him. That depicts his worthiness. And then toward the end there, it talks about he opens the books as the judge. Now, what book do you think that might be? The Book of Life. Yeah, yeah. We see it later in Daniel chapter 12. We'll see it toward the end of the book. He'll talk about the Book of Life, those whose names are written in the Book of Life. And then you get into Revelation chapter 20, and you also see the Book of Life there. All whose names are written in the Book of Life shall inherit the kingdom. We see that same language here. Okay? And so, how do you get into the Book of Life? Through good works, being a great person. No, through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, through faith in our one true God. There's two books in heaven. There's the deeds of the wicked. There's the works of man book. And then there's the Book of Life. And the Book of Life is the life of the book filled with the names of those who trust God rather than those who go their own wicked way, you know, so forth. So that's the Ancient of Days. So what happens when the Ancient of Days comes? Verses 11 and 12. He says, I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. So the fourth beast is found guilty. So Rome is found guilty and then destroyed. Now you think, well, why is God picking on them so much? He didn't fully destroy these others because as the text goes on to say later on, the other three beasts were allowed to continue on. You say, well, I thought they were destroyed. They were, but they got absorbed into what? The next kingdom, right? So Babylonian kingdom and the peoples kind of got absorbed into the next kingdom. And they got absorbed into the next kingdom. And they get absorbed into the next kingdom until you get to the fourth beast. And then the fourth beast, Rome, is destroyed to be no more, at least in the very end of things, right? Most people would argue, and I think I tend to agree with this, that though the Roman Empire itself is gone, the remnants of the Roman Empire are still felt today throughout the world. I mean, we got Roman numerals, we had a Roman calendar, Roman holidays, basically, that have been Christianized, and we got a whole branch of Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church, which is Roman, right? In Rome, Italy. You've got the influence of law. I mean, there's many good things that came out of it too, right? Out of this fourth beast. You got rule of law. You got representative government to a great extent, senatorial system and things like that. Our founding fathers were greatly influenced by Roman law and philosophy. Thankfully, also by Christianity as well, right? So I don't think that beast is completely dead in the sense that you go back to the Daniel chapter 2 and the statue, you get to the feet where the 10 toes are, and the feet and the toes are this iron mixed with clay. You remember? So that could very easily have the idea, I would say, of this fractured Roman Empire that's still there. I don't know. I'm still trying to work out some of these details, right? But I feel like Christ, the rock, came and grew and smashed the statue, and it's well on its way to dying and being toppled over, but it's not going to be completely gone until Christ comes back. I don't know. That's my best way of trying to explain it without claiming I know it all. You know, because there's three or four major Christian views on how the timing on these things. But I think we can at least agree on the big picture of how it might happen without getting into all the little details about this and that. So this fourth beast found guilty, destroyed. And then we get this next picture of the Son of Man. Okay. Son of Man. Who is the Son of Man? Jesus. Why do we know that? Without even reading this, how do we know that? Jesus says he is. What's that? He comes from the... Yeah. Christ himself said that he is. Christ ascended back to the Father with the clouds. Jesus says, I will come in like manner. He tells the Jewish Sanhedrin there at his trial. He says... Let's just look at the text. Matthew 26. I think it's important enough. This verse is the most quoted quoted Daniel verse in the New Testament for a reason. This idea about the Son of Man. So Matthew 26:64. Jesus said to him, you have said so. They just asked right before that, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so, meaning, yes, I am. It's just an ancient way of answering indirectly. But don't think it's an indirect answer. It's just a etiquette type thing, a way of saying things. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. So these men are educated in the Old Testament. Do they know what Jesus just said and what verses he's referring to? Yes. They know he just basically quoted Daniel 7. That's why in verse 65 they react like this. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. He's claimed to be Christ. And among them, there was probably even some debate as to whether would this Christ just be a man or would this be God coming to us? You know, they didn't really know. They didn't know what to believe for sure. They just knew Messiah was coming. Some of them probably had different views on that. So this is Jesus Christ. He's presented to the Ancient of Days. We might could argue that at his ascension after the resurrection and ascension, he went to the right hand of God the Father, presented to the Ancient of Days. He's given dominion, glory, and kingdom. Again, we covered this several chapters back. Jesus, where he's not waiting to get the dominion and the glory. And there comes the rain. He's not waiting. He's already got it. Right? Hope your windows are up. And then he says, all peoples, nations, and languages will serve him. And we tend to think, well, that's just going to be some far off day in the future when Jesus comes back. Well, fully and completely, that may be true. But I would argue already all peoples and all nations are serving him through how? Through the church. Because the church is not just one nation or one people or one country anymore. It's not just a Jewish people. What is the church of God? It's Jew and Gentile. And when we say Gentile, that's every nation, every Gentile imaginable, right? Okay. So I won't spend a lot of time there tonight, but... And then the last part of that, the Son of Man text in verse 14 says he will have an everlasting and indestructible kingdom. Again, not just coming, it's already come, yet it is coming. All right? It is already here, yet it's not yet. It's inaugurated, but not consummated. Christ is the coronated King of heaven and earth. Okay? Already. But yet, we understand that there are still things to be fulfilled before that comes about completely. All right. Last but not least, the interpretation of the vision, the last section. This will be the shortest, obviously, because we kind of already interpreted it, right? But notice in verse 21 and 22 in particular. Notice verse 21, this little horn that rises up made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancients of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. So God's people must endure persecution before, by the fourth beast, before the Ancient of Days is going to fully deliver them, is the idea. The fourth beast, which is Rome. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes and no. Yeah. Me personally, no, when it comes to what we're talking about tonight, this section, there's Christians have different viewpoints, okay? But I would say Rome, this has already been fulfilled in the past, in the first, second, third century, maybe early fourth century, before the Roman Empire became Christian. So the Christians were being fed to lions, arrested, persecuted, crucified, pursued, right? All that was happening. But the Roman Empire, back to Daniel chapter 2, is the legs of iron. But at the feet, there's iron mixed with clay. Partly hard, partly brittle. Almost indicating division, right? So maybe this fourth beast was Rome proper, the legs. But once Rome sort of passed away and they broke apart, where did Rome go? All through the whole world, right? So the Roman Empire influenced the entire world and still is today through their thinking, philosophy, even religion, etc., etc. Yes, exactly. Exactly it. Yep. Was, is, will be. Just like Revelation talks about it, it gives that threefold division. I'm going to show you what things have been, what things are, and what things will be. Yeah. What's that?
We could be a pinky toe right now.
We could be a pinky toe right now. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. He's one of their leaders, one of their kings. Yeah. So the... Yes. Yeah. I think yes and no. John in 1 John says, the Antichrist is coming, but I tell you the Antichrist is already here, for there are many Antichrists, right? So, when... forgot the Roman emperor's name. I want to say Titus. But when the Romans attacked Jerusalem in 67, 68 AD, there was about a three and a half year siege of Rome, right? It was not fully destroyed until AD 70. Daniel talks about three and a half years. Could that be a part of that? So Jerusalem, the temple, was not fully destroyed for almost three and a half years. And when they did, the Romans went in and they sacrificed swine on the altars and they desecrated the temple before they even destroyed it. So the point being, I would argue that that Roman emperor was an antichrist. Okay? Fulfilling this prophecy. Yet, I also would say that there is a final antichrist to come that will not just be oppressing the Jews, but God's people, the church. Right? Because Jesus said in Matthew 24, he says, when you see these things happening, flee. Flee from Jerusalem. And they did. The Christians in the first century fled. They left Jerusalem when the Romans attacked. And they destroyed the people of Israel, the Jews. I would argue that that same type of antichrist fire and destruction is going to come upon Christians worldwide eventually through the antichrist, the final antichrist. Is that helping, Brittany? I know it's. Oh, wait, yes, right. I kept looking at you, but you actually asked that last part about the little horn. Oh, you're fine. Yeah. So remember, the fourth beast, there's these 10 kings that come up. But then out of those 10 kings, there's one horn. There's an 11th horn on this beast. There's not 11 kingdoms. Although some would argue that, well, in the end times, there'll be some type of a confederation of countries, maybe the European Union or something like that. It has to be 10 literal, maybe. Maybe it's 10 literal, or maybe 10 is a number of a symbolic of completion. It might be just 2 countries or 20 countries, but it's the full number that God has ordained be a part of that final whatever it is. So 70 AD. Yeah, a siege of it. Right. Well, there is no more 3.5 years after, is what I would say. Yeah. I would say the first half of the first 3.5 years, first 7 years of that week of Daniel was when Christ came, leading up to that. I know. Yeah, I know. I struggle with it too. I mean, I know my view, but I still struggle with these things myself. Yeah. All right. Kind of said that. I said that. Yep. So he says in verse 18, God's people will receive an eternal kingdom. But what has to come first is the persecution and the trouble. But then the kingdom will come. And verse 28 ends. Daniel is troubled, to say the least. It says his color of his face changes. He's troubled. Yet I would say he was hopeful. It doesn't really say that directly. It says, I kept the matter in my heart. I don't think Daniel's so overwhelmed that he can't carry on. I think there's a hope in this man still. The same kind of hope that he's had throughout this book, and we're going to keep seeing him have throughout the rest of the book as well. So, yeah. Well, I apologize for all the history, but I feel like it's necessary on this chapter to understand what's going on. That historically, everything that Daniel prophesied has come, most everything has come to pass. Some things are still yet to come, of course. God is true. Yes, ma'am. Yes. He's pondered it. Yeah. That quiet, calm. That's where I got the evidence, I believe, for he's terrified, yet he's hopeful. Because what do Christians do when we're terrified and we're afraid? We trust in the Lord, right? We ponder this stuff in our heart. We ponder the goodness of God.